Today's podcast of The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Did any of you grow up wanting to be an airline pilot? Dashing, glamorous, professional man with a woman in every airport? Think again.
My first year, I made a little over $22,000. Gross. You know, by the time it all got said and done, we're literally starving at the end of the day.
You're talking about human beings who are flying my grandmother to Buffalo, right? Okay, so there are people there living this life, and it seems as if they're in an untenable position economically.
Small regional airlines account for more than half of flights within the United States. You think you're flying with Delta, but actually the flight's operated by a small company that pays its pilots about $425 a week. Here's another possibly unrelated fact. Regional airlines have been responsible for the last six fatal commercial airline accidents. Can you fly cheap and fly safe? It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning. It's Wednesday, February 3rd, and we just heard our good friend Miles O'Brien there. He's done an investigation into small regional airlines. We should point out, though, that flying statistically is actually safer than it's ever been.
Although, don't tell that to the victims of that Colgan Air disaster for about a year ago. The NTSB just issued a report on it. We're going to be talking about it a little bit later this morning. But in the headlines, Toyota's winter of discontent continues now. Its sales dropped 16% last month. We're getting word that there may be brake problems now with the popular Prius hybrid. The Prius is not part of the worldwide recall, but U.S. regulators have received about 100 complaints about its brakes. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood says the government had to pressure Toyota to take action over those sticking gas pedals.
Maybe they were a little safety deaf in their North American office until we went to Japan.
Federal regulators have launched an inquiry into whether faulty engine electronics may be another cause behind the accelerator problems at Toyota.
Not a pretty scene in the housing market either. In the past 2 years, the housing market has lost nearly $5 trillion in value, with a T, and nearly 6 million homes have gone into foreclosure. We're joined now by Ida Lidoskovsky, a reporter for WCPN in Cleveland. Ida, a house exploded in Cleveland on Monday, and that's somehow related to the foreclosure problem, right?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, a lot of these foreclosed houses end up getting dumped, and many of them get dumped to absentee landlords, which was the case in this house. The landlord, the owner, actually lived in California. And these absentee landlords often don't look after the houses. People come and go. These houses get looted. They fall apart. They're unkept. And usually it's just an eyesore for the community. But in this case, it actually turned out to be a huge safety hazard.
Okay, Ida Lidoskovsky from WCPN in Cleveland. Stay with us. We'll be back with you in just a minute.
In Pakistan, three U.S. Marines are among the 10 killed during an attack near an all-girls school close to the Afghan border. They were traveling in a security convoy to the school's inauguration when a roadside bomb went off. In Haiti, the 10 American missionaries arrested for trying to leave the country with a busload of children could find out today whether or not they will be prosecuted. The Baptist group, mostly from Idaho, say they were only trying to help orphans survive.
The nation's top intelligence officials say al-Qaeda will almost certainly try a major attack on the U.S. in the next 3 to 6 months. CIA Director Leon Panetta told a Senate hearing the terrorist group is deploying recruits to the U.S. to carry out new attacks from within.
It's the lone wolf strategy that I think we have to pay attention to as a threat to this country.
Panetta also said the terrorists are becoming harder to detect and are moving more quickly than in the past. Taking a look at the markets, futures are flat right now. The Dow will start at 10,296 when markets open, the S&P at 1,103, and the Nasdaq will open at 2,190. So with the Super Bowl coming on this Sunday, we're going to talk about party foods done in the style of maybe New Orleans for the Saints, maybe Florida because that's where the Super Bowl will be, or maybe breaded pork tenderloins from Indianapolis.
There's also news that music stars have recorded a new version of this song.
We are the world. We are the children.
Last week, you guys gave us six words about the State of the Union. What's the update for We Are the World? Sing us your lyrics at 877-8MY-TAKE or post it to our site, thetakeaway.org. Coming up, Miles O'Brien will take a look at the Colgan Air crash and regional airlines in a report later this hour.
Yeah.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning. You know, one of the things that we like to do on The Takeaway is give you a statistic and then help you understand what it really means with a concrete example. So here's the statistic. Nearly 6 million households have been foreclosed on in the past 3 years. Here's the concrete example. A home in Cleveland exploded, not only destroying the homes, but several of the homes around it, where some city residents got a firsthand look at what it means when houses are vacant. We're joined again by Ida Liaskovsky. She's a reporter for WCPN in Cleveland. Now, Ida, there is some question about whether this was arson rather than a gas problem in the home.
Right. So Cleveland fire investigators have ruled it intentional, and they've posted signs in the neighborhood to see if anyone knows anything about arson. But we've yet to hear the final word on what was the cause of the fire or the explosion.
But regardless of what the cause is, it's still really a problem of what happens when a home is vacant and unattended.
Exactly. So the owner of this house, they actually bought this house from a couple, but they live in California. It's a company called Easy Access Funding LLC. And they've also gotten dozens of houses from, for example, the Housing and Urban Development, who dump foreclosed houses to companies like Easy Access LLC. And these absentee landlords don't generally come to check out the houses. They never see them. And these houses go unkept and untaken care of.
How much do they pay for these homes on average?
Well, on average, houses that are dumped from the major players, they get a couple hundred dollars. For example, houses that Easy Access did buy from HUD, they went for $500.
Okay, so how is this a common problem in Cleveland? I mean, when you go to Cleveland, are there a lot of vacant homes?
Absolutely. On this street alone, a neighbor was telling me that they can see 10 houses, a dozen more houses that are sitting in the same unkept, uncared for condition. And they're absolutely forlorn, and people come and go, and they're looted and not watched over at all.
Okay, Ida Liaskovsky, reporter for WCPN Cleveland, giving us a concrete example of the foreclosure problem when it comes down to the street level. For some analysis, let's go to our next guest, Brett Berry. He's the associate broker for HomeSmart in Phoenix. Brett, you work in Arizona, obviously, but you're watching the entire national picture. And the Washington Post and some others have reported that the Federal Housing Administration, the FHA, is in trouble because of borrowers falling behind in their loans. Unfortunately, nobody from the FHA was able to join us this morning, but we spoke with FHA Commissioner David Stevens, and he had this to say.
While the numbers are high, we had forecasted for these numbers. We have reserves to pay losses based on those numbers, and there's nothing out of the ordinary that we're seeing that we didn't already expect. So it's bad. But we had anticipated it, and we've reserved for it.
What do you think? Should we be alarmed by these numbers coming out of the FHA?
Very much so. You know, we've heard these types of comments before. As a matter of fact, if we look back about a year or a year and a half ago, I think we heard similar comments as Mr. Stevens is mentioning from Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. There were a lot of questions being asked to Fannie and Freddie. They were government-sponsored entities. Regarding their reserves and whether things were okay. We kept hearing, and they kept telling everyone that everything was okay. And I think we know by now that things are not okay. And I think what consumers, you know, on a very simple level just need to do is just kind of look around their neighborhoods, especially in places like Phoenix, and they will see that the numbers of foreclosures is continuing to grow, and that is putting huge pressures on FHA. Real briefly, FHA basically insures loans. They don't make loans. A lot of people don't understand what FHA really does. And so what Mr. Stevens was saying is that he was alluding to their required reserves. FHA basically came into being in the mid-1930s, they have to keep a requirement of about 2% of reserves, and that requirement has been in place since 1934. And since 1934, they've never dipped below that 2% reserves until now. And they're now at 0.50% of their required reserves. That's required by law.
Okay. Now, the point, as you were saying, they don't issue loans. But what the FHA is intended to do is help people who don't have a full down payment to actually buy a home. And this is what FHA Commissioner David Stevens had to say about their mission in terms of helping hardworking families who can afford to make those payments but can't afford big down payments.
If you look at the FHA performance, low down payment loans work very effectively with creditworthy borrowers, borrowers with FICO scores, and proven histories of ability to pay their loans. over time.
What's your response to that, the mission of the FHA?
Well, I think that it's a very admirable mission. And, you know, folks like the National Association of Realtors, the NAR, and others, other lobbyists for the bankers' associations that are pushing these loans, you know, would love to continue to dole out loans with, you know, 3.5% down payments. The problem here, Celeste, is that the mortgage companies out there and the banks are using these loans in almost the same way as the zero down loans of the crazy go-go days. And if you call most local brokers who do these mortgages, they love FHA loans. FHA loans used to comprise about maybe 2-3% of all loans back in 06. Right now, here in Phoenix, it's over 50% of all loans. So now what we have, Celeste, is a situation of two, really almost too big to fail. And I have one more question that I would ask Mr. Stevens there at FHA. Why is it a God-given right that everyone should get a loan with 3.5% down payment? Very admirable. But why is that a right?
Well,
I mean,
he kind of answers that question. Let me give you his answer.
No, not everybody should own a home. If there's one lesson we've learned from this crisis we've come through, is that's one of the first mistakes that was made.
So that's his answer. Not everyone has a God-given right.
Well, you know what? FHA reminds me of someone that they basically got their foot on the gas full speed and their foot on the brake pedal at the same time. And that's pretty much what I see right now with FHA. They're juicing it up on one end and they're putting it on a dead stop on the other, talking about FICO scores and great quality loans. But I really don't, I don't believe what he's saying, not one bit.
Okay, we're getting some negative news from the FHA, but the news on the housing market overall, we've had kind of mixed. There's some good news there as well, so hopefully we will see some rise in housing values over the next few months. Brett Berry is an associate broker for HomeSmart in Phoenix. Just a note, you can see pictures of the foreclosed house that exploded in Cleveland on our website, thanks to Ida Liaskovsky of WCPN. Just stop by thetakeaway.org. Let's check in now on the headlines at 15 minutes past the hour.
Well, and keep you with that gas pedal FHA metaphor there. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood says faulty gas pedals in Toyota vehicles are a top priority for his department.
It may be the most serious safety issue that we have faced here at DOT.
LaHood says his department had to pressure the Toyota company to take action on those accelerators. Meanwhile, Apple co-founder and Toyota driver Steve Wozniak tells ABC News that his Toyota Prius, which wasn't included in the recall, sometimes unintentionally accelerates to 97 miles an hour when he uses cruise control.
I was actually pretty scared the first time, wondering, this shouldn't be happening.
He may be having accelerator problems, but today we're getting word there may be brake problems with the Prius as well.
In Haiti, an investigator questioned 5 of the 10 American missionaries arrested for trying to leave the country with a busload of children. Today, the investigator will question the others. He'll present his findings to the Haitian district attorney, who will then decide whether to prosecute. Back at home, following a primary in Illinois yesterday, centrist Republican Mark Kirk will face Democrat State Treasurer Alexia Janulis in the battle for President Obama's old Senate seat in November. Republicans have targeted that seat since former Governor Rod Blagojevich was arrested for allegedly trying to sell it. That's a look at some of the stories that we're watching this morning. Coming up, we're going to talk about whether flying cheap means flying safely. That's with our friend and frontline correspondent, Miles O'Brien. That's about 15 minutes. And we're also going to talk about the effort to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. That conversation in a few minutes as well.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
Our takeouts this morning include the voices of listeners out there, but also two contributors, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Good morning, Todd.
Morning, John.
And Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, sports contributor right here in the studio. Good morning, Ibrahim.
Good morning.
Todd, let's begin with you. The big story on Capitol Hill kind of crept up on me anyway. Mike Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and we spoke with him down in Washington when I was there with you just a couple of weeks ago. Very straight shooter in our interview, and certainly in front of Capitol Hill, a straight shooter calling for it's time to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell, claiming it was his personal belief, but a process is suddenly set in motion. How did that go down in Congress?
Well, you're right, John. Admiral Mike Mullen, the chief number one ranked uniformed officer in the United States military, saying it's time to end Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Robert Gates, the Secretary of Defense, said it as well. But Mullen really carried the most weight. You know, presidents have talked about ending Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense can ask for it, but they're civilians. Mullen is brass. And when the brass says it's time to end it, that carries enormous weight on the Hill. You had a chorus of these officials yesterday saying it's time to get rid of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And it was a chorus. And I talked with Senator Jeff Sessions, a member of the Armed Services Committee, a Republican member, just after the hearing, who already feels like Republicans are kind of getting steamrolled on this issue. He thinks Don't Ask, Don't Tell is working just fine. So listen to what he had to say.
We've got the president, the commander-in-chief, the secretary of defense, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, saying they've made up their mind. But this is a congressional requirement by law. They don't have the ability to decide this and change it without a national, you know, some sort of discussion worthy of the issue.
And Senator Sessions had some tough questions for Joint Chiefs Chairman Mike Mullen, Admiral Mike Mullen.
He did. And several of the Republicans did, presenting letters from, you know, 1,000 or so retired generals saying Don't Ask, Don't Tell is working. It shouldn't be repealed. But the Pentagon says it's going ahead with this, but they can't repeal it overnight and they won't try. And Gates has said that what they may try to do now is have kind of a year-long transitional period. They want to study this for a year. Now, studying something in Washington means kicking it until after the election, which is probably what they're doing.
It's a cynical view, but they were talking about actually exploring what the views were throughout the enlisted ranks.
They are doing that. But in the meantime, they are talking about making some changes. And I talked to Senator Carl Levin quickly, who's chairman of Armed Services, gave me a sense of what they might do between now and an actual repeal if they get a repeal. One, they may decide that a member of the military who's gay or lesbian can't be outed by a third party.
Right.
Can't be on someone else's say-so. If you are outed or if you come out now and you're discharged from the military under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, you only get half of what's called your separation pay for an honorable discharge. They would give you full pay under this transitional period. Third, they may have a moratorium on discharges pending this review. None of these things is decided yet, but Levin said that in this year long, if they have this transitional period, they may make these changes to kind of ease into an end.
Winds of change on Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Thank you.
And now let's move on to sports with Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen. We are counting down the days till the Super Bowl between the New Orleans Saints and the Indianapolis Colts. By focusing on some of the people playing on these teams that maybe you haven't heard of or working for the teams in this particular case, today we're going to talk about the Colts defensive coordinator, Larry Coyer. And the Colts defense wasn't what the Colts were really known for. They've been known for their offensive line. So how did this guy, Larry Coyer, turn it around?
Well, first I want to tell you, when I played in college football, I played under two defensive coordinators. The first guy would scare you to death. He would absolutely scare you to death. He was more of a drill sergeant. The second guy had a different demeanor. He was calm. He was relaxed. He would make fun. He would try and connect with the players. He would try and teach you. Coyer strikes me as the second type of guy. There's two different styles of coaching. People describe Coyer as a player's coach, and that's Larry Coyer.
And so you feel like he's turned this around not through ruling by fear, but by trying to help people get better.
I would say that he uses his storytelling ability. He's 66 years old. He's coached for 42 years, so he really came of age in a different era. So he uses basic memes and basic principles to really connect with players. And the other thing that he does is that he has fun. He makes things light. He makes things happy. And I think what he does is he rallies people around him, and I think he doesn't make it as serious and as intense, and he draws the best out of the players. So he has a very typical teaching style. He finds a way to connect with each player, and then he draws the best out of them.
This sounds great, except the Saints' offensive line is no joke. I mean, is the Colts' defense going to be strong enough to resist the Saints?
So the Saints have multiple threats. They have multiple looks. They're a well-oiled machine. The problem with the Colts this week is that their defensive end, Dwight Freeney, is injured. He has an ankle injury. So look to see how Larry Coyer rallies his troops around his injury and fills that gap. That is going to be the key to this victory if the Colts are going to claim a victory in the Super Bowl.
Thanks, Ibrahim Abdul-Mateen, Takeaway Sports contributor.
Good morning.
Our last takeout, kind of a surprise, the number of responses we got from you guys on the unemployed getting help from their friends and family and what kind of dynamic that creates. We heard this story at 877-8-MY-TAKE with how one listener got help from a friend named Sam.
This is Kelly from Pittsburgh. My husband's been unemployed since May, but luckily, as of January, he enrolled full-time back into college with his GI Bill. He was formerly in the Air Force, and we've both been able to stay in our home and be able to afford basic living expenses due to the housing allowance with the post 9/11 GI Bill. So we're very thankful to Uncle Sam.
And while many people are looking for jobs, it might be time for one group to call it quits TV shows. Last night marking the beginning of the final season of Lost, and we wondered what other show out there could benefit from an expiration date.
This is Johnny from Michigan. Remember back in the day when we used to have actual spinoffs and that was the way the network created loyalty for a show? Well, now we have the parallel shows. We have three different CSIs, and I love CSIs, but I'm really tired of it. There's just way too many crazies in Nevada, and there are way too many drug dealers in Florida, and there are way too many people who have a grudge against Mac in New York. It's time. Let's go.
Great suggestions.
Something's got to keep the economy going.
We actually got a lot more than that yesterday about TV shows that need to end at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can also post your suggestions to our website, thetakeaway.org. Coming up, was the crash of a small flight in Buffalo last year because of how pilots at small airlines are treated?
You know, by the time it all got said and done, we're literally starving at the end of the day.
The problem of flying cheap with our friend Miles O'Brien in a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, flying cheap could mean living dangerously. We're going to take another look at that crash in Buffalo, New York last year in a few moments. But right now, let's check in on top news stories at 30 minutes after the hour. The end may be near for Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Mike Mullen says it's time to repeal the military's policy banning openly gay troops from serving in the military.
I cannot escape being troubled by the fact that we have in place a policy which forces young men and women to lie about who they are in order to defend their fellow citizens.
Mullen spoke before the Senate Armed Services Committee. Earlier on The Takeaway, we spoke to retired Colonel David F. Beatty, a 30-year veteran who told us the military is not like the rest of society.
The military is a pretty cloistered sort of community, kind of like a gated community. It's a lot different than the rest of society. It's much more culturally conservative.
He supports continuing with Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Now to Haiti, the 10 American missionaries arrested for trying to leave the country with a busload of children could find out today whether or not they will be prosecuted. One of the detained, Laura Silsby, said they've done nothing wrong.
We're meeting with the government officials and talking with them. Everything is going very well. Actually, we are trusting God. We know God's going to bring it to a positive closure.
The head of Haiti's social welfare agency says the group enlisted a clergyman who went knocking on doors asking people if they wanted to give away their children.
There's been another attack this morning targeting Shiite pilgrims in Iraq. Our officials say a bomb on a parked motorcycle killed at least 20 at a religious ceremony in the holy city of Karbala. Meanwhile, an Iraqi official says an appeals court has rejected a ban imposed on hundreds of candidates with suspected ties to Saddam Hussein's regime. The decision opens the way for them to join next month's parliamentary election. And we're just getting word that private sector employees cut 22,000 jobs in January. That's according to the payroll processing firm ADP. We'll see what effect that has on the markets. Asian markets are up. European indices are down. Futures are down as well at the moment. The Dow will start at 10,296. The S&P opens at 1,103 and the NASDAQ at 2,190. Those are some of the news stories that we're following this morning.
Some bitter revelations yesterday that are unlikely to produce any closure for the families of the victims of that crash outside of Buffalo, New York a year ago. The National Transportation and Safety Board revealed the results from their almost year-long investigation into the crash of Colgan Air in Buffalo, New York. The report says the crash was caused by pilot error and that it was the pilot's complacency and confusion that resulted in this catastrophe. That's a quote from the report. While the NTSB were looking for answers, aviation reporter Miles O'Brien was conducting his own investigation into that crash and the whole issue of low-cost flying in the United States. He talked to former Colgan Air pilots. Here's former Colgan pilot Chris Wyken.
It's challenging. It's very challenging. A lot of short routes, a lot of takeoffs, a lot of landings, and going in and out of bad weather, being down low, especially at Colgan, flying the turboprops, you're not flying above the weather, you're flying in the weather. You know, 8, 9, 10 flights a day, it gets to be a very long day.
Miles O'Brien reporting that for Frontline, produced by our partner WGBH. The Frontline documentary is called Flying Cheap, and it will air next Tuesday, February 9th. Miles was the reporter on that, and you can hear him in the story there. Miles, right in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning. Good to be here.
So, you know, you looked at Colgan Air, but this is really a portrait of the difficulties and maybe some of the problems unearthed by that Colgan Air crash that relate to low-cost commuter air flying throughout the United States.
Yeah, a lot of people picking up their papers or surfing the web this morning are going to see a headline which says it was pilot error which caused that crash a year ago.
Right.
But it's much deeper and much broader than that. That's what our investigation found out. What we've had happen here without really realizing it is the airline industry has evolved into an outsourcing model.
Right.
And now fully 51% of all the flying in this country is done by these small regional or commuter airlines. And the big question is there two standards of safety with this system? Are these smaller regional airlines, are they at the same levels that their big players are? When you get in an airplane with that Continental logo, you think you're getting Continental
right.
service and safety. Not so.
So the system of hubs that we're familiar with when we travel has also produced this system of mini sort of air routes that sort of make up for the deficiencies that the hub system doesn't serve.
Precisely. This goes back to deregulation and the whole
right.
idea of hub and spoke and how do you feed those hubs.
And here's another pilot from, I got the pronunciation right, this is Corey Heiser. You interviewed him, right? And he's a Colgan Air pilot who talks about the conditions under which these folks work.
You are only paid when the door's closed and the engines are running. As soon as we block out of the gate, we close that door. That's when we start. All the time we're walking through airports, eating lunch, reading a book, while we wait for airplanes standing at the gate, you know, we're not paid for that time. We may be on duty for 80 hours a week and get paid for 20 of it, if we're lucky.
Again, an excerpt from the WGBH-produced Frontline piece that Miles O'Brien reported. You know, the NTSB said that the pilots in that Colgan Air crash were acting as though the flight was simply a means for them to have a conversation. Does that behavior come out of this idea that we're struggling, we're working long hours, hand to mouth? Flying is often an afterthought?
Well, first off, nothing excuses the actions of those pilots.
Sure.
That was one of the most egregious cases of pilot error and inattention I can imagine. I read these transcripts all the time. I've never read anything quite like that. Having said that, what we discovered is the foundation, the roots of this, are a system which treats these pilots poorly. They're not paid well. They're tired. They're in a system which, as one the pilots told us, says push the rig, move the rig. The regionals get paid only if they fly from point A to point B within a certain period of time, arrive on time. It has nothing to do with anything else as far as their payment. They don't have a situation where safety is rewarded.
So they may be in a nice uniform up there in the cockpit, but it feels like a sweatshop to them in their lives.
Sweatshop is a good term, and that has come to mind many times in doing this.
Here's Corey Heiser again describing what you actually conclude in this documentary is a two-tiered pay scale between the regional carriers and the major carriers.
My first year was, I made a little over $22,000 gross.
Mm-hmm.
And then you put into the fact that you have, you know, mortgages and rent for a crash pad, student loan payments, car insurance and whatnot, you know, by the time it all got said and done, we're literally starving at the end of the day.
Now, again, you want to stress that no matter what your financial situation, it doesn't excuse pilot error or negligence in the cockpit, but maybe flying consumers should know a few of these details.
Well, you know, it's interesting. We all want that cheap ticket. And I think we're getting what we're paying for at this point. We've created a system that is not as safe as we think it is. And that airplane, that smaller airplane that may have that major airline logo on it, is not flying under the same set of standards that you're used to.
So what's the upgrade here? What's the way, and literally it is an upgrade?
Well, it really this cries out for some government intervention. The FAA needs to step in and raise the minimum standards because the regionals do meet their minimum standards. The majors just go above and beyond what the FAA requires. So it's important for the FAA to step in here and change the rules on fatigue, perhaps address these issues of pilot pay, address these
issues. Let's just hold on pilot pay for a second. Do you think a pilot is a safer pilot if he's salaried rather than punching the clock every time he gets into the cockpit?
If you're making $16,000 a year and you got to live in Seattle with your parents and commute all the way across the country to sign in at Newark in the morning in order to get on your plane, are you safer? No.
All right.
That's an untenable situation.
All right. So any likelihood that the government is going to address these things?
This is a watershed accident. There is a lot of action right now. We got to hold them to accountable for this. We need some change.
All right. Small plane, big issues, though. Miles O'Brien, friend of the Takeaway Science and Aviation Reporter, he reported this new documentary, Flying Cheap, which airs February 9th on Frontline from our partners WGBH in Boston. It's all about looking 1 year later into the Colgan Air crash outside of Buffalo, New York. Coming up, we host the Super Bowl of food. We make a party menu with flavors of Miami, New Orleans, and Indianapolis. That's later this hour. And we've got an assignment for you. Next week, the new version for Haitian victims of the earthquake debuts of We Are the World. It's got new singers, but does it need an update in the lyrics? Call us with yours, 877-8MYTAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org. We are the, huh? This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Celeste Headlee. According to America's top intelligence officials, an attempted al-Qaeda attack on the U.S. within the next 3 to 6 months is certain. Here's a CIA director, Leon Panetta.
It's the lone wolf strategy that I think we have to pay attention to as a threat to this country.
With more details, we've got Siobhan Gorman, Wall Street Journal intelligence reporter. Good morning, Siobhan.
Morning.
Why 3 to 6 months?
Well, it's a little bit of an artificial timeline. It's actually just the way that the question was phrased to the intelligence officials who were appearing before the Senate Intelligence Committee yesterday. And the chairman of the committee asked what the probability was of an attempted attack in the next 3 to 6 months. And so what the first response from Director of National Intelligence Dennis Blair was, certain, and then everybody else on the panel, including Mr. Panetta, who you just had an excerpt from, agreed with him.
So are they giving us any details about what kind of threat they're talking about, or did they say that this could be an attack on the U.S. on U.S. soil?
On U.S. soil was the way that the question was phrased, and it was an interesting question, but very little follow-up, because basically the answer was very direct, it was certain, and then they just moved on to other questions. So there wasn't a lot of explanation that was provided along with that.
In terms of what kind of attack it could be. Well, you just heard Leon Panetta talking about the lone wolf strategy, which obviously is quite different from the coordinated attack that occurred on September 11th. Did they give you any details about lone wolf? Are they talking about more attempted underwear airplane bombings?
Well, actually, the underwear bomber Abdulmutallab wasn't really considered a lone wolf. He was actually Leon Panetta actually gave three different levels of concern that he has, and the first one is the coordinated attack, which is the type of thing that we saw in 9/11. The second was what we saw in the Christmas Day attack, which was an attack that was coordinated by an al-Qaeda affiliate, which in this case was Yemen with the Christmas Day attack. And then the third example that he gave was the lone wolf attack, which is what we saw with Major Hassan at Fort Hood in November.
Okay, they also mentioned cyber attacks during this hearing in Washington. And you've talked several times about this on the program. A director of National Intelligence, Dennis Blair, told the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence that American efforts are not strong enough to combat cyber threats.
Exactly. And actually, the other interesting thing that Mr. Blair said that jumped out at me was that sort of sensitive data was being siphoned off of both government and commercial systems on a daily basis. And that's the kind of thing that everyone sort of expected, but it's a little bit different when the Director of National Intelligence says this is a huge problem and this is what's happening on a daily basis.
When he talks about cyber attacks, is he just talking about pulling things off of somebody's internet site or out of their database, or does this also include things like pulling information off of the feed coming from U.S. drones overseas?
It would really be all of the above. Cyberspace isn't really just the internet. It is cell phones. It's anything that sort of communicates on a network. And so it's everything from intercepting drone feeds to bearing down inside Google's computer systems.
So maybe that could be the attack they're talking about?
The 6 to 8 or the
3 to 6 months.
No. They were talking about a terrorist attack, someone trying to,
violent
blow something up.
Assault.
Yeah.
Okay, Siobhan Gorman is a Wall Street Journal intelligence reporter. She joined us from Washington, D.C., talking about America's top intelligence officials saying an attempted al-Qaeda attack on U.S. soil is certain within the next 3 to 6 months.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. John Hockenberry here with Celeste Headlee. It's a big game. It'll get big ratings, and there'll be big appetites to go with that game. Super Bowl cuisine coming up beyond the chopped celery and carrot sticks and dip. Party foods from Miami, New Orleans, and Indianapolis. Just a few moments from now, but right now here's a check on leading stories at coming up to 48 minutes after the hour. President Obama is going to meet with a group of governors later today to announce new steps to increase the use of biofuels in the U.S. In Iran, President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad says he will ship uranium abroad for enrichment now. It's a change in policy. Fariborz Ghadar, an Iranian expert from the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, says the decision raises a key question. Where will the uranium go?
The devil is in the detail. Who's going to do it? When are they? Are they going to go through Russia and France, which I suspect that will not be the case, but they could go through Japan, they could go through Turkey, countries that both Iran sort of trusts and the U.S. trusts.
In other news from that country, the Iranian president has proposed a prisoner swap of Iranians in U.S. prisons for the three American hikers that are being held in Tehran. There's another problem for Toyota this morning. The automaker has been hit with more than 100 complaints in the U.S. about brake problems with the popular Prius hybrid. Already, Toyota has recalled 4.5 million other models because of faulty gas pedals. And in entertainment, Michael Jackson's physician is reportedly ready to turn himself in to face expected charges of involuntary manslaughter. The organization of petroleum exporting countries, or OPEC, has been influencing the world's supply of oil for 50 years or so. Earlier this morning, the BBC's Leslie Kerwin spoke with OPEC's Secretary General Abdallah El-Badri. She joined us from London to talk about that conversation.
Well, the Secretary General was telling me, first of all, that the recession is over, the economic recovery is fragile. He talked about demand being slow. I should tell you, by the way, that about a quarter of America's oil comes from OPEC nations. That's why it's particularly relevant to you. And he said he wants to make sure that the recovery is sustainable. He's pleased to see the latest US growth figures. But most of the demand, the growing demand, is coming from China and India. Now, what really is interesting is that he admitted that some of his own members, OPEC's own members, have been churning out more oil, much more oil than they'd promised to under agreed production cuts.
And here's what he had to say about whether or not OPEC is losing control of its member states.
We don't sanction them. We just urge them that they abide by the decision that we take at any meeting. It's a gentleman agreement.
The member states are part of a gentleman's agreement?
It's a bit surprising, isn't it? He has absolutely no sanctions at all to make them stick to the production cuts that they've agreed to. His worry is that the oil prices will fall if there's too much production. And what that could mean in turn is that there'll be less investment in new fields, new oil. When the big upturn in the world economy comes, and it will, there won't be enough supply for that demand.
Okay, that's Leslie Kerwin. She's a correspondent for our partner, the BBC.
Ah, yes, the soundtrack to the big game this weekend, the Super Bowl. It's long, halftime commercials. The game itself can be long. You have to eat during Sunday. The game gets underway at something like 6:45 p.m. What are you going to do if you have a Super Bowl party? Way beyond slicing up celery and carrots and opening bags of chips and melting cheese. Oh, my God. Super Bowl cuisine has advanced so far from those early days. And joining us now is Michael Schwartz, the chef and owner of Michael's Genuine Food and Drink in Miami. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
And right there with you is Jonathan Wright, executive chef of the Setai, right?
That's right. Good morning.
And that's a restaurant there in Miami. To both of you, Jonathan and Michael, what are you recommending for a Super Bowl cuisine that is both exciting, maybe even more exciting than the game? Super Bowl games don't necessarily have a reputation for being particularly exciting and also doable for home chefs. Michael?
Well, I think the biggest thing to keep in mind is that the Super Bowl reaches such a broad audience that people aren't just interested in pizza, like you said, and dip and chip. So, here in Miami, you'll see a lot of you'll see a lot of pigs roasting in La Caja China and lots of black beans and rice and vibrant flavors that, you know, take advantage of what's happening now in South Florida.
Now, you know, we've got the options here of exploring Miami's cuisine because the game is going to be in Miami. We've got New Orleans cuisine because, of course, one of the teams is the New Orleans Saints. And we've got Indianapolis, the Colts. I have to say, Jonathan Wright, that at least in the cuisine side, Indianapolis would seem something of an underdog here. Would you agree?
Yeah, I could.
You don't have to agree. You don't have to agree.
I'm actually fortunate that I spent 4.5 years in New Orleans and moved into that in late 2005 after Katrina. So New Orleans is very, very close to my heart. And, you know, we'll be doing some dirty rice and some beignets, and we'll have a pot of gumbo on the stove stirring, and some great cocktails and so on. But I think Indianapolis, it's we're certainly going to do, you know, we'll do some variations of a corn dog and maybe some pork patties and some great sandwiches and burgers. But it's they're a bit shy of the cuisine that's coming out of New Orleans in Miami. That's for
sure. No one can compete with New Orleans. Let's just say that right off the top. Michael Schwartz, is that a good strategy for you know, for a Super Bowl kind of party to have something that's cooking on the stove, say a gumbo or a stew or something like a pig roast, where people can just sort of slice and go back to the TV?
Yeah, that's the best strategy. The worst strategy is for people to have to wait for food. So as people come in and out, and you said the game's long and it goes on for a long period of time, there's got to be stuff ready, prepared, that people can come and grab and go.
All right, Jonathan, tell me about your fried green tomatoes with shrimp remoulade and a Creole julep to boot.
Okay, well, the recipe for that comes from a restaurant up in the Garden District called Upper Line. Susan Clevenger and the chef there, Ken Smith. And I go back every year for Jazz Fest, and every year I go back to Upper Line. And they have simple fried green tomatoes. It's about half-inch thick green tomatoes. They're floured and dipped in cornmeal and fried. We'd make a classic remoulade sauce with Creole mustard, ketchup, hot sauce, emulsified with oil, red peppers and tomato.
Fabulous.
And then you'd take in these, you know, fantastic Gulf shrimp that we're fortunate to get here as well, the wild Gulf shrimp, you know, poach them, you know, just lightly mixed up with the remoulade sauce, and then they just sit on top of the fried green tomatoes. And it's just a great combination of the crispness and so on, and the wonderful shrimp. And then, you know, there's no better place for the New Orleans for classic cocktails. And we do a kind of a spin on a Ramos Gin Fizz, where the satay is a very Asian property. So we've taken a Ramos Gin Fizz and thrown in there some coconut milk and some yuzu and some lime leaf and
nice.
Turned that around.
Nice.
Our interpretation.
That's Jonathan Wright, executive chef of the Setai, which is a Asian fusion restaurant there in Miami, right?
It's a hotel. The Setai is a Southeast Asian hotel, and
right.
One of the main restaurants is Asian. Yep.
Michael Schwartz, given that you know, you might say that Super Bowl Sunday is one day that all of America celebrates men who weigh about 340 pounds and can lift up a house. Is fried food maybe the reason why, or is that maybe the reason why there's so much fried food in these Super Bowl parties?
First of all, I want to say I'm going to Jonathan's to eat. That sounded good. You could talk a lot about fried food and the, you know, what's great about it and what the problem is with fried food, and I think it certainly has its place, and I would say that certainly Super Bowl Sunday is a time and a place for fried food.
But tell me about your chicken wings with papaya slaw and genuine margarita.
Yeah. The chicken wings, the great thing about chicken wings is that, you know, you could fry them or bake them. So if you feel like a little bit of guilt, you could pop them in the oven, just make sure that they're crispy. The thing with the chicken wings is that they don't, you know, it doesn't have to be about buffalo. Certainly not this Super Bowl. So the chicken wings has a real nice tangy sauce. It's got lots of components, but tahini based and you know, bright vibrant flavors. And we paired that with a green papaya slaw. So, you know, we're at the height of our growing season here in South Florida, which is the complete opposite of the rest of the country.
Well, you know, the game is Sunday, and in Miami, the New Orleans Saints are one of the teams, the Indianapolis Colts the other team. The Colts are favored. At the end of the game, of the whole spectacle, do you think the gumbo pot's going to be empty and there'll be a pile of those Indianapolis corn dogs on the table if your party consists of both cuisines?
No, I think people will eat whatever you put out.
And of course, that is perfectly right. Jonathan Wright, lads, take us out.
I think that's who's going to win. I mean, that's the question.
The cautious chefs of the Super Bowl Miami, Jonathan Wright, executive chef of the Setai, and Michael Schwartz, chef owner of Michael's Genuine Food and Drink, handicapping the cuisine for the Super Bowl. Thanks to you guys. You can see recipes on our website. Learn how to make those fried green tomatoes with shrimp remoulade and chicken wings with papaya slaw, along with all the cocktails at thetakeaway.org.
So if you're going to watch the Super Bowl and maybe eat some of those foods, you're probably not going to the game, but as your congressman, we're trying to find out what politicians are going and how did they get their tickets. Go to thetakeaway.org to help us out. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway. The U.S. military tiptoes toward a new policy on gays in the uniformed services.
Guiding principle of our efforts will be to minimize disruption and polarization within the ranks.
Starting a conversation that's been going on for a while in the civilian world.
I'm a gay man. I'm very, very gay.
But there's no laugh track when the chairman of the Joint Chiefs speaks.
It is my personal belief that allowing gays and lesbians to serve openly would be the right thing to do.
The beginning of the end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
It's not true! It's not true!
Is the Pentagon's conversation real or just Seinfeld?
Not that there's anything wrong with that!
On The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee from Public Radio International and WNYC.
Good morning, everyone. Wednesday, February 3rd, and as Don't Ask, Don't Tell gets explored on Capitol Hill, The Takeaway is the difference and similarity between the conversation about sexual orientation in the military versus the civilian world.
And it seems so strange. It does feel like an old conversation, like we already dealt with that a long time ago in our personal lives. But let's get right to the top stories we're following this morning. Thousands of Afghan and NATO troops are preparing for a major offensive in the southern province of Helmand. That's the hub of an Islamist insurgency that's raged for more than 8 years, officials said this morning. The operation will be led by Afghan security forces as part of plans to hand over military and policing responsibility to the Kabul government. Also, Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood describes Toyota's growing troubles like this.
It may be the most serious safety issue that we have faced here at DOT.
LaHood says it took U.S. government pressure to get Toyota to initiate last week's recall. Today, federal regulators have launched an inquiry into whether faulty engine electronics are behind the accelerator problems. And that all comes as we're getting word that there may be brake problems with the popular Prius hybrid. It's not part of the worldwide recall, but U.S. regulators have received about 100 complaints about Prius brakes, including two crashes that resulted in injuries. Now to Pakistan, three U.S. Marines are among the 10 killed during an attack near an all-girls school close to the Afghan border. They were traveling in a security convoy to the school's inauguration.
This week, Secretary Robert Gates announced a one-year study to see if the ban on Don't Ask, Don't Tell, or the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy may be lifted in a year's time. Admiral Mike Mullen yesterday, the Joint Chiefs Chairman, made a strong appeal before Congress yesterday for allowing gays to serve openly in the military. For more on that, we're joined by retired Colonel David F. Beattie. Colonel, good morning.
Good morning, John.
You have strong feelings on this. We're going to explore them in some depth. But as a 30-year veteran of the U.S. Army, Colonel, why would the military lag behind the civilian world in integration of these groups when it has led the civilian world in issues of, say, racial diversity?
Yeah, that's a good question, John. And as you have pointed out, this is a pretty complicated issue. But I'd like to go back to a statement that General Colin Powell made in 1993. He in answer to a similar question, he pointed out that a comparison of sexual orientation and race is a convenient but invalid argument because of the fundamental difference in these human characteristics and how we respond to those. But without getting into the social science here, the place we find ourselves in the United States right now is that we have a civilian world that is conflicted by homosexuality. We see strong evidence of increased tolerance, but a lot less enthusiasm for other aspects of the homosexual agenda, for instance, gay marriage, even in states like California.
Well, a lot of conflicting agendas here, and we're going to see how that plays out. Stay with us, Colonel Beattie.
A few stories out of Iran this morning. In a major shift, Iran now says it's ready to send its uranium abroad for further enrichment as requested by the United Nations. And also in what's calling a successful advance in its space program, Iran launched a rocket this morning. Looking at the markets, Asian and European markets are up. Futures are down. The Dow will start at 10,296. The S&P opens at 1,103. And the NASDAQ opens at 2,190.
Join a conversation that the military is going to begin to have over the next year. Don't ask, don't tell. Is it a doctrine we should keep in the military, or should gays be allowed to serve openly? We're going to talk with a retired colonel about this issue. We want to hear what you have to say at 877-8-MY-TAKE or comment at thetakeaway.org.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Good morning, everyone. On Capitol Hill yesterday, you could hear the beginnings of the end, maybe, of a controversial policy that dates from the Clinton era. For 17 years, don't ask, don't tell has been the doctrine for gays serving in the U.S. military. In that time, there have been studies documenting the effect of the policy, which was enacted by Congress. There have been political movements devoted to changing the policy and cautious warnings about how disruptive it would be to have openly gay members in the services. But yesterday, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mike Mullen, testifying before the Senate Armed Services Committee, said it was time for a change.
It is my personal belief that allowing gays and lesbians to serve openly would be the right thing to do.
His personal belief. But Senator and former Navy pilot John McCain said to Mullen that such a change could upset a fragile apple cart that don't ask and don't tell has kept upright for nearly a generation.
It has helped to balance a potentially disruptive tension between the desires of a minority and the broader interests of our all-volunteer force.
There's a feel of the voices in Congress before the Armed Services Committee yesterday. Meanwhile, in the broader culture, this tension referred to by Senator McCain is reflected in bans on same-sex marriage, a politically divisive issue. But also, it's a much more open conversation. In fact, the question of who's gay and who's not is beyond open in civilian culture. It's kind of everywhere.
You know how I know you're gay?
How?
You're not so crazy about Gloria Estefan, but you love Miami Sound Machine.
You know how I know you're gay?
How?
Every time we go to eat, you want to sit on the terrace.
You know how I know you're gay?
How?
You're always talking about public radio.
Man, how insulted would a gay guy be if he was here?
Certainly an argument can be made that Seth Rogen and Paul Rudd there are signs of the decline of civilization on many levels. But without question, it is a completely different conversation in the civilian world than it's going to be in the military and the services as they begin a one-year study of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Joining us once again is retired Colonel David F. Beattie, 30-year veteran of the U.S. Army. For 12 years, you were on the senior faculty of West Point, right, Colonel?
That's correct.
And you're joining us from your home in Montana. Welcome back to The Takeaway.
Thanks, John.
How's this going to work? You know, we heard that silly kind of tongue-in-cheek Seth Rogen clip there from a skit they did on television. But say openly gay people can serve in the military. How's that going to change the conversation, say, at the enlistee level? You know, maybe not in combat, but where actually men and women are working side by side. How's it going to work?
Well, you know, I think that remains to be seen. It's a fact that we do have homosexual people serving in the military right now. The current policy allows that, as Senator McCain pointed out. It just requires a great degree of discretion. I think that the major difficulty that we'll see, though, with open service in the military will not be reflected so much at the unit level. I expect that there will be some effects there. But I think that the larger effect is the effect that it will have on the entire military community. What most people don't understand, because, frankly, since we have an all-voluntary force now and have had for decades, is that the military is a pretty cloistered sort of community, kind of like a gated community.
Right.
It's a lot different than the rest of society. It's much more culturally conservative. And we could spend an entire segment talking about why that might be the case, but I think that most would agree that that is so.
Although, Colonel, there are you know, conservative movements in the civilian world that have homosexuals in them. A lot of prominent Republicans during the Reagan era were openly gay.
That may well be the case. I think what a major source of concern for many people in the military who are concerned, who harbor concerns about open homosexual serving, is the motivation of the advocates of this movement. We think, I mean, some of us believe, that the next step will be a move to extend full rights to same-sex couples. President Obama is committed to that, and full federal recognition. The military provides an easy place to make that happen, and what many of us think may be the consequence of that is the introduction of same-sex couples in military family housing areas.
And you've certainly identified a controversy that exists both in the civilian world and in the military world. But listen to, and you couldn't find a more buttoned-up officer than Joint Chiefs of Staff Admiral Mike Mullen testifying yesterday. He says there's a moral issue here. Listen to this, and then I just want to see if you recognize this at all.
I cannot escape being troubled by the fact that we have in place a policy which forces young men and women to lie about who they are in order to defend their fellow citizens.
Now, that, of course, is his personal view, but do you deny there's a moral issue there?
Well, technically, there is not a requirement to lie in order to be in the service if you're a homosexual. There is a requirement that you serve discreetly and not make your private business the business of other people. And I think many of us are more comfortable when folks keep private matters to themselves.
Now, one of the things you argue in an essay that I read this morning is that the cohesion of the military is really at risk here, that the specialization of the military community, and you've described it as a kind of a gated community, right?
Yes.
Means there are special rules and people have to follow them. Is there evidence that openly gay people in the military don't follow those rules, that they behave in ways that are disruptive?
Well, at this point, we don't have openly serving gays in the military, so that is a proposition that needs to be tested. Once again, I think that the most significant problem that we see, the most destabilizing thing, will be the furthering of the homosexual agenda within a very traditional culture that is that has developed, and it is a culture that is fundamental to maintaining the cohesion of the units. You cannot think of our military today simply as a collection of soldiers or collection of units. It's a collection of soldiers, units, and the families that stay behind or have to deal with the hardships that are associated with military service.
But does disagreement over issues like homosexuality affect readiness and manifest themselves differently than disagreements over politics or anything else that soldiers are likely to disagree about?
Well, I think that because of the as Colin Powell pointed out, the fundamental human characteristic associated with your sexuality and your sexual orientation is much deeper and affects people much deeper and more viscerally even than our politics do, which is kind of hard to believe given the politics that we have in this country right now.
Well, Colonel David Beatty, thanks so much for giving us a feel for how this conversation is going to begin in the military over the next year as they study Don't Ask, Don't Tell. David Beatty is a 30-year veteran of the U.S. Army, 12 years on the senior faculty of West Point, lives in Montana. Thanks so much for being with us. At 15 minutes after the hour, let's check in on some of the other top stories we're following.
NATO troops will soon launch an offensive against Islamic insurgents in southern Afghanistan.
The Afghan National Security Forces and ISAF, as partners, are preparing a major operation in central Helmand.
That was NATO spokesman Brigadier General Eric Tremblay. He says the operation will be led by Afghan security forces as part of plans to hand over security responsibilities to the Kabul government. But also this morning, our partner, the New York Times, says training the Afghan police force is a constant challenge. That's because of the high death rate, poor pay, and a lack of equipment. It's leading a quarter of the Afghan officers to quit each year. Top intelligence officials say they believe Al-Qaeda or one of its affiliates will attempt a large-scale attack on American soil within the next 6 months. CIA Director Leon Panetta says he's particularly worried about the danger of extremists acting alone.
It's the lone wolf strategy that I think we have to pay attention to as a threat to this country.
Panetta says terror organizations are sending operatives, including so-called clean recruits without a trail of terrorist contacts, to the U.S. to carry out attacks from inside the country.
About half of the 10 American missionaries arrested in Haiti for trying to leave the country with a busload of children have been questioned by investigators. Today, the remaining detainees will be questioned. Finally, Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood says Toyota was, quote, a little safety deaf about problems with those gas pedals on some of its cars. LaHood said the government considered penalties against the carmaker and had to pressure it to order the recall. Let's look at some of the stories we're following this morning. Coming up, some bad news for the housing market. More people are thinking of walking away from their houses. What does it mean?
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Hey, you want that to go?
We're going to start our takeouts this morning by picking up where we left off a few minutes ago in talking about the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. We talked with retired Colonel David F. Beatty.
There is not a requirement to lie in order to be in the service if you're a homosexual. There is a requirement that you serve discreetly and not make your private business the business of other people. And I think many of us are more comfortable when folks keep private matters to themselves.
No surprise, we've been getting some strong reactions from our listeners at 877-8-MYTAKE.
So I guess this gentleman is saying better to have more soldiers die, keep doing not so great in the war, but lose people in the military because they're gay, but better to just let them go for a little discomfort. I'm sure there's plenty of people already dealing with this in the military, you know, and that it's just as pervasive in the military as it is everywhere else, and people already are dealing with this.
And Peg posts to our site, thetakeaway.org. She says, I'm very concerned that our conservative military are coddled and encouraged to be unaccepting of homosexuals and that they will not be able to tolerate our civilian society when they return from service. We've also been hearing from people who have experience with the military and have insight into the culture, like John here.
The Army is not exactly known for having this very healthy culture. The fact that John McCain and various other people are discussing that gays serving in the military would destroy Army culture. I mean, there is no Army culture, and Army culture is completely unhealthy.
This is Michael from the Bronx. As a former United States Navy Seabee, I do believe that the stance that Admiral Mullen took was the right stance, although I see it being a pretty tough obstacle because there is a culture within the military that is extremely offensive towards the gay community, but I think that's something we can overcome.
Some really great reactions from our listeners, as always, and we want to continue to hear from you on this issue. Anything you hear actually on the show at 877-8-MYTAKE or post to our website, thetakeaway.org.
You can hear the real conversation in all of those voices, including Colonel Beatty, who we spoke with earlier. Our next takeout is with Louise Story, New York Times Wall Street and Finance reporter. You know, it got me thinking a couple of weeks ago when Tishman Speyer, this huge real estate developer in Manhattan, just walked away from a $5.4 billion investment in a residential property called the Peter Cooper Village. It just walked away from it, just handed it back to the banks. Take it. We can't pay anymore. It got me thinking, hey, why don't I do that with my own mortgage? Turns out, according to the New York Times, more and more people are thinking about walking away from their mortgages. Louise Story, what does that mean?
Well, what studies are showing is that 75% is the magic number. What that means is when your house becomes worth only 75% of your mortgage, that's when people really seriously start saying to themselves, wait a minute, these monthly payments I'm making are not going towards owning my home. I'm just giving the money to the bank. And that's when people say, what am I doing? What am
that's
I doing? Should I just default?
Now, how does that mental shift affect all kinds of credit lines and risk assessments and really the solvency of banks, some of them who are holding these mortgages?
Well, the banks are counting on people to pay these. You know, there's a very interesting figure in the Times article today. It says that if you were to make everyone's mortgages and home values equal, if you were to, you know, bring them back up, you know, give them the money where their home has decreased in value, it would cost $745 billion.
Wow.
That is how much money in value we are underwater as a nation on our homes. And banks are counting on people to pay the full value of their mortgages. They don't want to lose this $745 billion dollars. So it's a huge banking question. It's a huge personal question for people. And I wonder, you know, with a more mobile society where people don't live in the same homes all of their lives, if people aren't going to continue, as we're seeing, making this financial calculation and saying, you know, forget it.
Forget it. And quickly, is it measurable, the numbers of people who may have this on their mind?
Yes. So we already know that by the fall of last year, 4.5 million people were at this critical 75% point where they'd be seriously thinking about it. And it looks like it'll be up to about 5 million people,
5 million.
1 in 10 homeowners.
And 6 million have already foreclosed. Celeste, we were saying that this morning already.
That's exactly
so
right.
It's like 10 Detroits. Thank you, Louise.
Thanks.
For another takeout, we're going to go to the Boy Scouts. They're turning 100, and they've decided it's time to reinvent themselves, in particular so some parts of America that doesn't know them quite so well, like Hispanics. Marcos Nava is the Hispanics Initiative's team leader for the Boy Scouts of America, and he's spearheading the new outreach effort, which has a pilot program in Denver. Good morning, Marcos.
Good morning.
How many Hispanic Scouts do we have right now?
Currently, we have about 130,000 that have declared themselves to be Hispanic Scouts.
That's out of 2.7 million.
That is correct.
Uh-huh. That's a tiny slice and doesn't even begin to represent the number of Hispanics who live in the country, right?
That is correct.
So this is the issue. So how do you go out and actually target Hispanic young people and get them into the Scouts?
Well, first of all, the national office has a Hispanic initiative that is just doing that. It's the targeting six consuls, and we actually added, we've been so successful that we added 31 more consuls where it has high Hispanic populations. And we're helping those consuls by setting up some marketing processes to reach out to the Hispanic community and be able to tell them what are the benefits of the Boy Scout program to their families.
Do you think that you know, maybe for an organization that's 100 years old, maybe it's just seen as kind of old-fashioned and conservative?
Well, you know, it's funny that you would say that because I think kids still like to have fun. Fun is never going to go out, and scouting is fun. I can go to a classroom, and I can race, and I can talk to students, and I ask them, who wants to have fun? Every hand goes up. So if we are able to communicate the fun to the kids and the values to the parents, and then, you know, it never goes out of date.
That's Marcos Nava, the Hispanics Initiative team leader for the Boy Scouts of America. Happy birthday, BSA. Coming up, we're going to talk about the aftermath from the Haiti quake that's led to a lot of assistance coming out of Miami and southern Florida. And so let's take a look at what the city's been doing to help out. We'll talk with the mayor of Miami, Tomas Regalado, in a few minutes.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Celeste Headlee.
Coming up, the connections between Miami and the country of Haiti can't be overstated, and certainly the relief effort coming out of that city has been strong. We're going to talk with the mayor of Miami, Tomas Regalado, in just a few moments. But first, here's some of the news stories we're following at 30 minutes after the hour. A large offensive is being planned for southern Afghanistan. NATO spokesman Brigadier General Eric Tremblay breaks down the troop numbers that will renew the fighting in the Helmand province, a Taliban stronghold near Kandahar.
There will be at least 1,000 Afghan national police, thousands of Afghan national army, and many thousands ISAF troops.
Tremblay went on to explain the goal of the offensive.
That will further separate the insurgents from the population and enable the Afghan government to deliver proper governance and offer development alternatives.
The offensive is expected to be launched within days.
Trying to make sense of what the country's top intelligence officials told Congress yesterday, Al-Qaeda reportedly will almost certainly try a major attack on the U.S. in the next 3 to 6 months. CIA Director Leon Panetta spoke yesterday.
My greatest concern, and what keeps me awake at night, is that Al-Qaeda and its terrorist allies could very well attack the United States.
Within the next 3 or 6 months, certainly? Well, we asked Wall Street Journal intelligence reporter Siobhan Gorman about that timeline.
It's a little bit of an artificial timeline. It's actually just the way that the question was phrased to the intelligence officials who were appearing before the Senate Intelligence Committee yesterday.
In other news, more problems for Toyota this morning. The automaker has been hit with more than 100 complaints in the U.S. about brake problems with its popular Prius hybrid. What a difference a year and a split makes. In its first quarterly filing since splitting from Time Warner, AOL says this morning that it swung a profit in the last quarter. AOL said it made $1.5 million compared to a $1.9 billion loss in the final quarter of last year. Markets are open on Wall Street as futures were up and down all morning, but now the Dow has opened negatively. The Dow's down about 27 points, the S&P down about 2 or 3 points, and the Nasdaq down about the same proportion. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
This week, we're welcoming WLRN in South Florida to the Takeaway family, and part of WLRN's coverage is Miami. Joining us now is the mayor of the city, Tomas Regalado. Good morning, Mayor.
Good morning, Celeste.
Well, I'm surprised you found time for us because Miami has definitely been in national news a lot lately. It's the staging ground for many of the relief efforts traveling over the water to Haiti. Many of your constituents there in the city are Haitian Americans as well. So what is the morale now with a very large Haitian population in Miami?
It is, Celeste. And actually, we have an area of the city called Little Haiti. And the Vice President and Secretary Napolitano visited with us 2 days after the earthquake. And from day one, the city has been very proactive and the residents. Of course, the support has been overwhelming for the people of Haiti. We opened all the fire stations. We secure several warehouses 20 hours after the earthquake. Our USDAR team from the City of Miami Fire Department landed in Haiti. They were there for 12 days, rescued more than 50 persons, did an extraordinary job. And through the Sister Cities program, because Miami is sister city with Port-au-Prince, we have received donations from cities throughout the United States. Just last week, Mayor Daley from Chicago sent 2 ambulances, which were shipped from here, from Miami, to Haiti. So we're proud of the work that the residents of Miami are doing for Haiti.
Many of the residents of your city there in Miami were among those calling for special status for Haitians, immigration status, to give them a little bit more protection, and that the government is not offering that. Do we expect any adjustments in that policy? Are you asking the federal government to perhaps protect Haitian immigrants?
Well, absolutely. That was one of the issues that we addressed with the Vice President when he came down here to Miami, and Haitian leaders also did that. And the administration, as you know, has extended the status to the Haitian people living in the United States before the earthquake. And that's, that was a very good move because we had like 10,000 Haitians nationals in deportation order here, and that would have created a very difficult social problem for us.
So, Mayor Regalado, you know, we are thrilled to have listeners in your city and all over South Florida joining the Takeaway family this week. And as you've described, with all of the complicated relationships between the people of Miami and nations throughout the hemisphere, I've got to figure your job as mayor of Miami is one of the toughest in the United States. Do you ever feel like you need a secretary of state in addition to, you know, dealing with the sanitation and everything else mayors have to deal with?
Well, you know, we don't make foreign policy. We just suffer the foreign policy of the United States. But let me tell you, yes, we have so many issues that deals with Latin America. Last Sunday, we had demonstrations of Cuban exiles against a Cuban group that came to Miami. We have had many Haitians demonstration. We had Venezuelans demonstrating against Chavez. So this is, I guess, this is sort of a United Nations here in sunny Florida.
And yet you still have the same issues that the rest of the nation is dealing with. And in fact, in cases like housing, Miami is suffering at a higher level than most of other cities. How is Miami recovering, or are you recovering yet from the housing crunch?
We're we are not recovering yet. We have serious problems with foreclosures. We are one of the biggest areas of foreclosures. We have many empty condo buildings due to the condo craze building of years before. But we're moving along. I mean, we have also good news. I mean, we have the New Orleans Saints in downtown Miami, and we just had the ING Marathon with 18,000 runners last Sunday in Miami. So there's good news coming from Miami, too.
Well, let me ask you about a campaign promise that you made when you were running for office. You promised to restore the iconic Miami Marine Stadium that was badly damaged all the way back in 1992 during Hurricane Andrew. Can you tell me, where is that process now in bringing Miami Marine Stadium back?
Well, you know, that's only one of two in the world. The other stadium underwater is in Singapore. And yesterday I had the pleasure of welcoming Bonnie Burnham, the president of the World Monuments Fund. And we have the UM, University of Miami Architecture School, working on the plans. And we are asking the state of Florida and the federal government for money to restore. I think it has been declared historic. We're proud of it. It's unique in the United States, and we believe that with the help of the state and fundraising by the private sector, we will be able to restore it and have an extraordinary venue, because this is a stadium that faces the bay, and it has a tremendous look and an ambience here in Miami.
It's an icon on the skyline for sure, Marie.
It is.
Tomas Regalado is the mayor of Miami. He joined us from his own city down there in Florida. Thanks so much for joining us, and welcome to
all your consistent.
Yeah, thanks. Welcoming our listeners at WLRN in South Florida this week to the Takeaway family. Coming up, we're going to talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for the Miami Herald, Leonard Pitts. He always has a lot to say. He's going to join us later this hour. This is The Takeaway. I'm Celeste Headlee.
And I'm John Hockenberry. And the suddenly very public Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood is certainly keeping Toyota in the headlines.
It may be the most serious safety issue that we have faced here at DOT.
That's LaHood talking about how he says it took U.S. government pressure to get Toyota to initiate last week's recall for those defective accelerator pedals. And all this comes as we're getting word there may be brake problems with the popular Prius hybrid. Joining us now, Paul Eisenstein, publisher of the DetroitBureau.com. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning. Good to be with you, John.
This is an unusual position for Toyota to be in, it seems to me. How do you think they're handling it? And the costs are really mounting.
Well, if everything were on the table, if we were pretty confident that it's over, and if we weren't having Ray LaHood raising serious questions, and if consumers weren't asking questions, everything'd be fine.
Because,
but unfortunately, it's not.
Yeah,
it's
so,
not. The problem is that this is sort of a very fast drip, drip, drip. Every day there's new headlines. As you know, we now have confirmed something that we reported on The Takeaway just a month ago.
The Prius hybrid brake issue.
Yeah, exactly. Toyota has now confirmed that they are doing an investigation of reports that there's a problem with the Prius brakes. Now, they're calling it an inconsistent feel of the brakes. What our owners that we've spoken to are saying is that the brakes, under certain conditions, when they're braking and hit a pothole or bump, will fully release, forcing them to take drastic, rapid actions to prevent the car from racing out of control, losing its braking power. And That's a very
right.
serious issue, as you can imagine.
Well, again, it's only at the investigation stage. We've got reports, and you found them at the DetroitBureau.com. We've talked about them here on The Takeaway, and the Transportation Secretary is apparently aware of all this as well. I'm detecting a pattern. You know, a couple of years ago, we were talking about how Toyota's business strategic decisions to get into the truck market really led to some financial problems for Toyota. Now we have these quality control problems. Has Toyota become too U.S. automaker kind of company for its own good? It seems to me they've done exactly, learned exactly the wrong lessons from being in the U.S. market.
It's interesting. They're learning the wrong lessons, just as Detroit's record is showing that they're learning the right ones.
Exactly.
Ford is becoming very much Toyota-like, GM's system. In fact, there is evidence out there, there's some studies that show that the Detroit makers, particularly the big two, Ford and GM, now have better productivity than Toyota, and their quality is starting to beat Toyota in a number of studies. It's very interesting to watch. I'd be careful before I sort of say that, you know, if you become a U.S. type automaker, you become a bad. In fact,
It took a long time for U.S. automakers to go through this trough. If Toyota has embraced some of these bad strategic decisions, they've got a long time to get out of this. That's really the comparison I'm looking for.
Well, the fact is that every day they're getting burned by another headline and getting slammed by the Secretary of Transportation doesn't help. Toyota has some serious problems. It's going to take them a while to dig out.
And investors are seeing those problems as well. Toyota stock fell 5.7% in Tokyo trading today. Paul Eisenstein, thanks so much. Paul Eisenstein, of course, friend of The Takeaway, publisher of the DetroitBureau.com, reporting from Detroit, Michigan on Toyota's woes that Toyota and the Transportation Secretary, Ray LaHood, are keeping in the headlines, apparently.
You're listening to The Takeaway from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. I'm Celeste Headley here with John Hockenberry. Coming up, we're going to talk to Miami Herald columnist, syndicated columnist, and Pulitzer Prize winner Leonard Pitts. He has a lot to say about some of the issues surrounding Haiti, race, and politics. And we're also going to welcome our new listeners, WLRN, for whom he is very familiar. That's in a few moments. First, here's a check on leading stories at 47 minutes after the hour. Later today, President Obama is expected to meet with governors from coal-producing states. He hopes to earn their support for a stalled energy bill. The president is also expected to announce new steps to increase the role of biofuels in the U.S. He'll talk about a new report on ways that Washington could increase investments in green technology. The president is the only one who's busy this morning, First Lady Michelle Obama tells NBC.
Americans are rightfully frustrated, and the person in charge is the person folks look to.
First Lady says the president should be the one to lead the country through these tough times. Moving on to Haiti, this morning our partner, The New York Times, says paper coupons that can be redeemed for 55 pounds of rice have become more valuable than Haitian money. It's part of a new food distribution program from the United Nations. One UN worker says the coupons have been primarily distributed to women because they are most likely to share the food.
All around the world, we'll always look to distribute food into the hands of women. But in terms of giving coupons to women to give them access to the site and then to collect food, this is a unique response to a unique challenge here in Haiti.
Big story out of Iran this morning. President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad now says Iran will have no problem giving the West its low-enriched uranium and taking it back when it's been enriched by 20%. In Iraq, another violent bomb attack against Shiite pilgrims near the holy city of Karbala. At least 20 are dead. Transportation Secretary Ray LaHood says his department had to pressure Toyota to take action on faulty gas pedals that provoked that recall we've been reporting about all week. This morning, federal regulators are now looking into whether engine electronics caused vehicles to accelerate unexpectedly. And we're getting word there may be brake problems with the popular Prius hybrid. Those are some of the stories we're following this morning.
Good morning. As of this week, starting this week, South Floridians can turn on the radio and join the American conversation that happens every day here on The Takeaway. And we're happy to welcome another very familiar name to those who are in South Florida. That's Leonard Pitts. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning and syndicated columnist at the Miami Herald. Actually, his column appears nationwide, and he joins us now on the phone. He's the author of Before I Forget. In the interest of full disclosure, though, Leonard, I have to say I read all of your columns in the Miami Herald. I am a huge fan of yours. I'm so grateful you're able to come on the air with us today.
Well, thank you very much. That's a way to start a day. Thank you.
Welcome to the interview. I want to start with you about the tragedy that's going on in Haiti. It's something that you've written about several times. It seems to have awoken some very strong feelings for you, as it has for many people. You've written on one hand about the resilience of the Haitian people, but the opposite reaction was to what you called obscene comments about the earthquake. I'm wondering about these two opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of reactions to the tragedy in Haiti.
Well, the obscene comments were those that were made by the Reverend Pat Robertson, who suggested that maybe Haiti was getting payback for some sort of deal they made with the devil, supposedly 200 years ago, and then from Rush Limbaugh on his radio program, who suggested that. I can't recall his exact words, but who said something that was not...
He was playing to the base. He was trying to get credibility.
Saying that in helping Haiti and sending aid to Haiti, President Obama would make himself look good, specifically with African Americans. And I just thought that this was... We sort of become these people that we weren't 20, 25 years ago, at least as I recall, and maybe I'm just looking back through rose-colored lenses, but I seem to remember us as being these people who would help and who had, there was a certain sensitivity, there was a certain compassion that, you know, there's just certain things that were not said, certain things that did not reach the public sphere, one of which was to blame the victims of one of the, you know, worst natural disasters, certainly of this new century, and perhaps, you know, of all time, to sort of somehow blame them for what had happened to them on the one hand, or to look at what happened to them in these very crass and coarse and also incorrect political terms was just beyond the pale. But I think it's sort of emblematic of you know, this poison that's entered the public sphere in terms of our dialogue.
You comment about this very issue quite a bit in dealing with Katrina as well, and I'm wondering if you think that we're repeating the same lessons. Did we learn anything from Katrina?
We may or may not have learned from Katrina in terms of getting aid to affected areas, but what these comments tell me is that we have not learned, you know, a basic and, if I may, biblical lesson about, you know, demonizing and stigmatizing, you know, and victimizing victims of tragedy. You know, the fact that the Reverend Robertson could say something like that, even though, as you know, his followers will say, well, he's asking his people to give money, et cetera, to Haiti, which is lovely. But the fact that he can come back and suggest that they somehow deserve what happened to them says more, frankly, about us as a country, or at least some of us as, in this country, than it does about Haiti. Those kinds of things, that's so far beyond the pale, it's just unconscionable.
Well, Leonard Pitts, I don't want to ruin your day. I haven't read all of your columns like Celeste has, but I am still a fan.
I'm
still...
Conversation over.
Right, there we go. But, you know, columnists are people who give themselves permission to maybe speak more candidly or with a harder edge to Americans about issues. And you've described in a couple of examples right there. I'm wondering if over your long career you've seen a degradation of American discourse in that people seem to have permission to say almost anything on any subject. And, you know, the idea of communication and getting to the truth maybe gets lost in something like that.
Yeah, I certainly have, and again, it's not the sort of thing it's the sort of thing that's difficult to quantify, but it's the sort of thing that is almost viscerally there if you spend any time, you know, observing the public discourse. My sense of us now, as opposed to once upon a time, is that now we argue for the sake of arguing, we fight for the sake of fighting, as opposed to once upon a time, if there were arguments, there was at least a point you could at least trust that the people who were engaged in this argument had some higher purpose in mind other than stigmatizing or making somebody else look bad. I think, you know, we're sort of in this state of permanent argument, permanent abuse right now, where there's nothing apparently that we can all agree on or nothing that we can all get behind, with the exception, I guess, of the September 11 attacks, and even that didn't last very long. But beyond that, there seems to be nothing that really pulls us out of this thing, this reflexive thing of retreating into our ideological bunkers no matter what the issue is. I mean, you would think that the one thing that we could agree on is earthquake strikes very poor nation, let us help, and that's in you know, any way that we can. You'd think that would be the one thing that people of all ideological, philosophical, religious, socioeconomic, whatever stripes could agree on. And the fact that a very prominent individual from the conservative Christian side of things could say something like that, and the fact that Rush Limbaugh could reduce it to that crass political equation suggests very strongly that, no, we can't even agree on that.
You know, I have to ask you about another conversation that's been going on, and that's the issue of race, which you write about constantly. And I'm wondering, looking at President Obama's presidency, looking at some of the comments made by Harry Reid and Chris Matthews and the conversations they've sparked, do you think that his presidency is leading to some really in-depth, nuanced conversations about race that we haven't had before?
I think it is leading to in-depth, nuanced conversations that we haven't had before, but I also think it's causing some people to reveal themselves as perhaps not as enlightened as they would have otherwise liked us to believe. I think that it's causing the nation to show itself in ways that are, you know, surprising and in some ways very disappointing.
Leonard Pitts, a Pulitzer Prize-winning syndicated columnist at the Miami Herald, also author of Before I Forget. Thanks so much.
So for our listeners everywhere, including our new listeners in South Florida, you can get more of the show and follow the news all day on our site, thetakeaway.org. Now, while you're there, you can write up a sneak peek. You can take a look at the sneak peek of the stories we're working on for the next day. You can read along as the news develops. To follow our blog, stop by thetakeaway.org and click on blog. And one of the things coming up for tomorrow is the New Yorker cartoonist Roz Chast and Dr. Gary Small are going to talk about how Google changes the way we think about information. The immensely talented Roz Chast has some enormously important insights there. Be sure to tune in for that tomorrow. We also have our eyes on Friday because that's when we look at who's been having a good week and a bad week with our friends at The Week magazine. Who would you like to nominate? Shab in Detroit emails. Who's having a bad week? Toyota. Good week? Detroit auto companies, primarily Ford and GM.
That's a turnaround.
There you go. Give us your nominees from the news. Who's having a good week and a bad week at 8778-MY-TAKE, or you can just post it to our site, thetakeaway.org.
I'm Celeste Headlee.
Hello, South Florida. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Thanks for listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If there's a story you think we should look at or a conversation you'd like us to start, drop us a line at 877-8-MY-TAKE or email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.